It was around sunset. The birds were flying back to the comfort of their nests. As we sat down with Waleed Al-Hajj in his beautiful home and garden for our chat, where he shared the story of his life. It is a story of courage, of vision, and of his dedication. He set up Cravia in 2001 to be a world-class food and hospitality organization. Fast forward to today, he has franchised very recognizable brands like Cinnabon, Seattle's Best Coffee, and Zaatar Wazeet, amongst many others. He started this project after his studies at Harvard Business School, where it was developed as a business case study. The rest, as they say, is history. Today, we're going to be talking about this history and his life. We are really privileged to be here with Waleed Al-Hajj in this beautiful environment. He's invited us to his home, and we're sitting in the garden and really just enjoying the beautiful weather. And while we're having this beautiful weather on the one hand, on the other, we should have a chat about thought leadership, about your future, Waleed. Really,
thank you, Tarek. Thank you. Welcome.
Pleasure to meet you, and thank you for welcoming us in this beautiful home. It's wonderful to do that because, you know, we end up in offices most of the time.
Yes.
And it's really nice. Thank you for changing the flavor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the idea. Thinking out of the box, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You have a great organization. You pronounce it Cravia?
Cravia.
And what does Cravia mean, and what does it mean to you?
Well, the words come from craving, right? And it really stops there. Cravia as a word doesn't mean anything. It means a lot to me, of course, right, in more ways than one. Right. It's, I guess it's like a baby. So I have built it with a team, of course. I didn't build it alone. Built it with a team, saw it grow, and almost saw it, you know, just like you with your kids, you take them to college, right? Yeah. So in a way, I went through the whole process, and that's what Cravia is about.
So what is what are the companies that are included in Cravia, and how does the whole group come together?
So Cravia is basically a food franchise operator. Mm-hmm. We focus particularly on franchises and restaurants.
Okay.
And the brands that we have currently under the company are about five or six brands. So we have Cinnabon, Seattle's Best Coffee, my favorite Zaatar Wazeet. Yes. You always have a favorite, right?
Yeah, your homegrown products are always
there. Right, I mean, you know, Zaatar Wazeet coming from the Middle East, and also saw it evolve as a brand over time and helped in evolving it. Yeah. In addition to Five Guys Burgers from the States and Carvel Ice Cream.
Okay, so two of these four amazing brands, one of them is Cinnabon. I look at it, smells really nice, and I try to walk past it.
Please don't do that. Please don't walk past it.
I think you're trying to pull us in through the smell. You probably have this sort of fan working. Tell us whether that's real.
No, it's not real. Well, it is real in the sense that, you know, it's a very impulsive product. So 75% of people who shop at Cinnabon actually is not planned.
Because you know, there are three or four smells in life that you cannot walk past.
Yeah.
The smell of fresh bread.
Yes.
A smell of fresh coffee brewing.
Right.
And Cinnabon. I cannot walk past it.
Well, the nice thing is we have fresh bakery as well.
Right.
So they're both, you know, the cinnamon and the fresh bakery.
Yeah.
But we don't have fans that blow any smell out. The cinnamon smell is, you know, the aroma is very strong and it gets around. So that's great. But it's a great pull factor for sure.
It is a great pull factor. Absolutely. Seattle's Best is something I use almost on a daily basis.
Yeah.
The only one thing that I would like you to add on that is almond milk.
Okay.
And the reason for that is there are a lot of people now who are lactose intolerant, like myself.
Sure.
So, and soya milk is not good for guys, apparently. Almond milk is the only thing left.
You know, noted. I'm going to make sure we include it in our next product development discussions.
Thank you.
But it's an easy one, and I'm sure we can do it.
And I love the coffee, it works really well.
Yeah.
What about the others? What about the Zaatar Wazeet, and what was the thinking behind that?
Well, you see, Zaatar Wazeet is a Lebanese concept.
Right.
It started out of Lebanon about 20 years ago. We took the franchise about 10 years ago.
Okay, you didn't create it, you took the franchise.
No, we you know, I'd like to think that we created it, because to be honest, we helped develop it.
Right.
When Za'atar Zayt came to the UAE, they were a small brand. There were about four or five outlets in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. So they're not your typical, you know, massive franchise. They're not the McDonald's in any way. So we, you know, with Cravia, Za'atar Zayt developed and became what is now really one of the leading brands in casual dining. Mm-hmm. So it's a phenomenal brand the way it is today. It has one of the best, I think, product mixes that allows for an all-day kind of dining. So you have, you know, your breakfast crowd, you have your lunch, dinner, after hours as well. If you're out late at night, this is the best venue after club hours.
Tell us how you differentiate a brand. I mean, basically, it's doing shawarmas and saj and whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's different? What's special? What differentiates you?
Yeah,
I always wonder.
This is really the million-dollar question, right? And if everybody knows, or anyone knows the answer to this, they crack it. Look, at the end of the day, I like to always say that the brand has to be different.
Yeah.
It cannot be a me-too brand. Yeah. And Za'atar Zayt is truly that. And today, if you look at it, not only here, but even in Lebanon, the amount of competition that it has is very, very few. I mean, there are very few that directly competes with Za'atar Zayt. And a lot of people who tried to imitate it and failed. So what is really unique about Za'atar Zayt is this ability to get together a traditional Lebanese, you know, menu, mm-hmm. but mix it with sort of a modern wrap concept. And this is really what evolved in the brand. And it wasn't like this when we started, obviously. Mm-hmm. But in the last 5-6 years, this has been the brand, and this has worked very well.
Mm-hmm. In terms of product development, what sort of things do you do? Focus groups? Do you get? Are you sort of relaxed about developing a product, or is it remain very, very focused?
It depends what brand. I'll tell you a funny story. Mm-hmm. Five Guys Burgers, for example, who, you know, believe in focus, and focus for, you know, is really at their core, core value. They only sell burgers and fries and hot dogs, but mainly burgers and fries. And they've been that way for over 30 years since they started.
Right.
When I visited their office in Virginia, they said, and I was very new to the brand, so the father, the guy who started it, said, I want to show you our product development room. And I said, wow, great, let me take a look. Yeah. And we went to a door that says product development. We opened it, and there's a brick wall behind it. He said, we don't have any product development. We focus on our products, our existing products. We make them better every day.
Yeah.
And we don't want to, you know, sort of get, I guess, you know, lose focus. Mm. You know, it depends on the brand. And that's the beauty of, and the difficulty and the challenge of working with a franchise. Because as Cravia, you know, you're dealing with different franchises. Mm. You're dealing with companies that believe in product development, but you're also, you know, dealing with companies that don't, and look at focus and continue, you know, being focused on a small menu. So with Za'atar Zayt, for example, product development is key. And although a lot of it happens at the franchisor level, a lot of it is actually coming from us. So, you know, I don't know if you noticed, but about a year ago, we launched tandoori chicken in Za'atar Zayt, particularly for the Asian community that we have. We launched kale salad for the health freaks that we actually sometimes maybe, you know, exclude by, you know, by the menu as it used to be. So a lot of the product development comes in from talking to customers. Mm-hmm. We do not conduct focus groups.
Right.
There are situations where you need it to understand your brand and understand the direction. But at the end of the day, it really is the interaction with the customer when they're in the restaurant. Which means talking to, you know, your waiters, talking to your managers, and actually being there to talk to the end consumers themselves.
In the inimitable style of Hollywood and Bollywood and Lollywood, whichever way you want to look at it, let's do a flashback to your early stage of your life.
Right.
Where did you grow up?
So I was born and grew up in Saudi Arabia,
right.
In a small city called Al Khobar, Saudi Arabia.
I know Al Khobar.
So Khobar is one of the smallest cities in Saudi Arabia. And I have to tell you, I mean, I know you're doing a flashback, but I want to tell you again a little bit of a proud story that I always like to say. So we opened Five Guys in Al Khobar about 8 months ago.
Right.
And this was the second store we opened in Saudi Arabia after Riyadh. And again, I mean, we opened it because there was an opportunity. We got a good site. But Not in my wildest dreams did I think that actually Al Khubar will turn out to be the number one store in the world. Mm-hmm. So imagine, I mean, you know, they have this, my home city, my hometown. It's a small town. It's not Riyadh. It's not Jeddah. It's not Medina. It's not Mecca.
Yeah.
Yet performing very well. But yes, I grew up in Saudi Arabia. I grew up in Al Khubar. Went to school there. Went to university there. Mm-hmm. And then worked for Procter & Gamble in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia for a couple of years, mm-hmm. and then moved on to do my MBA at in the States at Harvard. Okay. And then came back to the family business. Mm-hmm. And the family business in Saudi is also in food, but not in restaurants.
Okay.
So my father established a food business that deals with distribution, manufacturing, logistics. Mm-hmm. So I sort of took over with my brother when I came back from college, from master's in 1995. Mm-hmm. A few years later, we had the opportunity to expand into the UAE. And, you know, I mean, at that time, I thought to myself, wow, you know, that was 99. I said, wow, the UAE is a great place. I want to, you know, have a piece of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wondered if it had reached its maximum. Mm-hmm. Imagine it, in 99. So we moved, we got the business. The Cinnabon franchise was the first one we acquired.
Okay.
And little did I know that the UAE and Dubai in particular were just getting started.
So as a youngster, were you a naughty child? Were you a problem child? Or were you well-behaved?
Well, I don't know about problem child. I don't know about problem child. I think I was well-behaved, but I was not your calm child. So I remember, you know, in grade one, and my mother actually keeps telling this story, I ran away from school.
Okay.
And didn't run away. I mean, ran away and came home. Mm-hmm. And my mother was shocked. You know, 10 o'clock in the morning, she opened the door and had this little kid, 7 years old, who actually walked from school,
right.
You know, 8-9 blocks minimum. Mm-hmm. And I stood there and she said, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
And I said, Mom, you know, they're not teaching us anything new.
Yeah.
So I guess I was naughty, I'll confess. but I had a good childhood. I think, we grew up in a very close family. I learned a lot from my father. Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, if you talk about entrepreneurship, to me, he's the ultimate entrepreneur. So
why was he an ultimate entrepreneur, and what was that moment of inspiration? And we'll probe into that, because
sure.
A lot of people get their inspiration at an early stage from people like yourself.
Sure, especially in this part of the world.
Yeah.
Look, I the ultimate entrepreneur to me, and my father is an ultimate entrepreneur in my eyes, because he took a degree of risk that I think, you know, is usually attached to entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. but he took it in a way and at a time when, you know, was really risky. And so my father he fled Palestine in 1948. Mm-hmm. He's a refugee. Was a refugee in Lebanon for a while, and then moved to Saudi Arabia. And then when he came to Saudi Arabia, worked with a company as an employee for a few years, and then decided, you know, I have the savings. I'm going to put it all mm-hmm. in this business. And, you know, every time he tells me the story, I freak out.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, he said that when he decided to do that, he remember, you know, taking everything, buying stocks mm-hmm. with it, you know, products. And in his new office, he said that in the evening, I thought about my mother, who I supported, mm-hmm. my father, my two brothers who were studying in college. He's the eldest child. And then my five kids and my wife. And he said, I broke down, I put my arms and I started crying, and nobody saw him. But he said that ultimate moment, to him, that moment ultimately decided, you know, that he has to make it work.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a true inspiration, because, you know, being challenged and having this difficulty and deciding, you know what, it's going to work, I love it, I know it's going to work, and, you know, make it work is really something.
It's the metaphor of burning your boats when my namesake, Tarek Bin Ziyad, landed in Spain.
Sure.
It's, you know, it's victory
or death.
You have no choice. There's only one way forward. Did that define you, and does that shape your business success? Because you have this inner belief that I can't go back.
Yeah.
There's only one way.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the risk-taking definitely comes from my father and because I grew up with the business. I mean, the business is almost... I would say, you know, I'm 10 years older than my father's business when he started. So when he started the business, I was maybe 10 years old. So I saw him go through that process. So and it defined me in many ways. And I think one of them, and I didn't know this until you sit back and reflect on it. But watching my father, you know, put everything that he has, not money, but everything that he has in terms of effort into the business. My mother even, you know, he brings his business home.
Absolutely.
And he discusses it with us.
Yeah.
So it became sort of entrenched in me. On the weekends and holidays, I used to go to his office, send telexes at the time, if you're old enough to remember what a telex is.
Just about.
So I grew up in the business, and I sort of got fed that kind of food, basically.
You know, Palestine impresses and fascinates me a lot, because when you look at Palestine in 1948 and many other countries, but everybody there was an entrepreneur. You were a fisherman, you go and get some fish and you sell. You're a carpenter, you're an entrepreneur.
Sure.
You're working in the field, you're an entrepreneur.
Sure.
So entrepreneurship was in their blood. And your father's generation was a generation that built the platform to enable you to thrive.
Absolutely.
And that generation is the golden generation, my father's generation, your father's generation.
Sure.
My father emigrated from India to Pakistan in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
And
almost at the same time.
It's exactly almost the same time. It was August 47. And that refugee mentality of success at all costs becomes an integral part of our DNA. And they spend their next 20 years building us.
Absolutely.
And I think that, to me, is my defining moment, is that there's only one way, and then our parents have sacrificed.
Sure.
And so now we build.
Sure.
Do you have children?
I do. I have three children. I have two girls who are, 17 and 15.
Okay.
And a little child, boy who's 10.
How, as a father, how do you see them evolving in this new era?
Yeah.
Because when you grew up with a little bit of hardship.
Sure.
Now they have much less hardship.
Yeah, I worry
about it. Which is your blessing, I was going to say.
Yeah.
You grow up as entitled kids.
Yeah.
When I interview billionaires and stuff, I said, you know, everybody admires you, but we also look at what are your problems.
Yeah.
And one of them is children.
Sure.
So how do you imbue the same intensity and the same quality and values that you came from within you into your children, into your family?
Look, honestly, it's one of the most difficult jobs that you can get. Being a parent, especially with this kind of privileges that you have, and again, we're lucky, and I tell my kids that, you know, I wake up every morning, you know, praying and thanking God for all his blessings, and so should you, you know, because they are lucky to be where they are. They're lucky to have what they have, and they're lucky to have the opportunities that we're able to provide them with. Honestly, we do a lot of things. We're very conscious about raising the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So what we try to do is we try to get this money element out of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And by out of the picture, I mean, so our kids don't know what our financials are. They don't know, you know, how much money we're making. Yeah, obviously, as they grow older, they look at around, they realize few things. But, for example, they have a weekly allowance that we are very strict with. Every once in a while, my eldest daughter, for example, is very much into, you know, helping the refugees in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether that's related to her grandfather being a refugee. And I'm sure, you know, he's... my father, when we sit with him, especially with the grandkids, you know, all he talks about is Palestine and how he fled Palestine and how the bombings and how his cousin got injured and he put him in his, you know, carried him on his shoulder and took him. So I'm sure that has some kind of an effect. But going back to the children, I mean, Yasmin, my eldest daughter, I'm really proud of her in that way. She's a very this refugee is very refugee cause is very close to her heart.
Mm-hmm.
So she's been to Zaatari camp in Jordan. She's been. Even she went to Guatemala, helped kids in need, built schools, built bathrooms in Africa. So we try to show them that, you know, the bubble, if you will, if you want to call it that way, that we're living in, is not the rule. And, I hope they never have to go through that. But at the end of the day, there is a risk that all this can disappear in one day, and you have to be able to live and support yourself and build yourself that way. So it's a very, very difficult job.
Yeah.
I think parents have to be aware of it, and I think Maha, my wife and I, are very aware of it, and we try to do the best we can. We'll see if we're successful or not.
No, inshallah. I think all of these basics that you've mentioned, the core values are there.
Yeah.
The rest, they will have their own wings and they will fly.
Sure.
Coming back to your business and your early days, and you said you were an entrepreneur and you took risks. Could you take us through the journey and through the story of how you came to your first franchise and how you built it up, and what sort of risks did you take?
So the risks I took are, this breaking away from this comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
or your comfort area. I mean, I was living very comfortably after I came back from the U.S. You know, my father's business and my family's business in Saudi is quite large. It sustained me and my brother and was very comfortable. And it was actually a very nice lifestyle. I mean, contrary to a lot of what a lot of people might think about Saudi Arabia, you know, my wife and I, we had just gotten married at the time. So we lived very comfortably and you know, we enjoyed life. I think the main risk, I mean, I didn't take as big a financial risk as my father did. Mm-hmm. I didn't put everything I had in one basket and wished for the best. But I think what I've done is I wanted to, you know, I pulled my, if you will, pulled the roots out and said, you know what, I love the business that I'm in. I love my life, but I want something different. I want to feel that I've created something. Mm-hmm. And this is really the drive that drives me. It's not money and it's not recognition. I mean, yes, sense of achievement in a long way, in a big way, to see and to ensure that you see something that grows and you, that you helped grow is a big thing. Mm-hmm. But taking that tree, pulling it out of the roots and trying to plant it somewhere else was a big thing for me. And a lot of people discouraged me to do it. A lot of people said, you're crazy to do that. I mean, you know, who could wish for better?
Sure.
But to be honest, in retrospect, it's the best thing I've ever done in my life. Starting a business, moving to Dubai, and you know, starting all over again.
Right. Any early failures, any early challenges that you'd like to share that would inspire people?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think I'm proud of our failures as a business, just as I'm proud of our successes. Mm-hmm. And I tell people and I tell our team that, you know, don't be afraid of taking risks, because what's the worst that can happen? You can fail. It's all right. You know, I'm your boss and I'm telling you it's all right.
Right.
So we launched a brand. I mean, one of the things I can tell you, we launched a brand called Roadster Diner in 2008, 2009. At that time we had two brands, Zaatar, Rosetta and Cinnabon. But we launched Roadster, which is also a Lebanese brand, but it's a diner concept. Failed miserably. Failed miserably, and you know, until today, if you ask me why, I wouldn't know.
Yeah.
So you know, everything said it was going to succeed. It was the leading, diner in Lebanon. Beats, you know, the international names, and yet when we opened, actually, the line was out the door. But then something went wrong. Whether it's quality, whether it's consistency, whether it's the time. Also, it was the time of
the
crisis at the time. But whatever it is, the amount of learning that we got out of that was tremendous.
Right. Now, as you were building your businesses, what sort of methodologies, discipline, the kind of technical stuff that we need to be aware of in a franchising business?
Yeah.
Because a lot of people get quite seduced by franchises.
Yeah.
They think it's simple.
Yeah. No, it's not. It's not at all.
And why not?
Well, I'll tell you, because, so the beauty about franchising is that it's a packaged, tried out concepts, right?
Yeah.
It has worked somewhere.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be a franchise to begin with.
Yeah.
Most of the cases, anyway. But taking that and applying it in a different market, different environment, with different people, mm-hmm. may or may not work.
Right.
So to us, the way we evaluate franchises and the way we decide to choose franchises, mm-hmm. I would say is 20% technical mm-hmm. and 80% gut feel.
Okay.
And the 20% technical has to do with the companies that we're dealing with. Are they ready to go international? How is their supply chain? Is this something that will appeal to the local market? And the bulk of it is really, you know, people feeling. Mm-hmm. And what I do is I try the product, I love it. If I like the concept, I try to close my eyes and imagine it in our markets and see how that goes. Mm-hmm. And then I encourage our team, you know, our CEO, our COO, our operation people, even our store managers, you know, and we pay them to go actually on a trip if need be. You know, just go and try it as a customer, tell me what you think. And you'll be amazed by the amount of feedback and insight you get from that.
Franchising has always seemed to me to be a very process-driven and operationally intense business.
Yes.
Would I be right in thinking that?
Absolutely.
And is that your core energy that is derived from that, or is it something more than that?
I think there are two things that drive me as far as the franchising business, and I'm talking about me personally, which I think has sort of cascaded down to the company. Number one, we believe in brands. Mm-hmm. So the idea of, you know, we're getting a franchise so that tomorrow we can make a big buck and turn around is not in our books.
Right.
You believe in brands means you invest in the brand. Zaatar Rosette, and I'll, you know, maybe this is a company secret, but I'll share it with you, was losing money for the first 3.5-4 years. Mm-hmm. although we were very successful on the commercial side, I mean, the stores are full, but we're losing money. The business model didn't work.
Right.
Yet we continue to be fully invested and vested in the brand because we believe in the potential. And today it's one of our best brands. So the idea of believing in brand is very big. That's number one. Number two, operational excellence is actually in our vision statement and in our core values. So when we execute, we don't care how much it's going to cost. We're going to execute to the best that's possible. And that reflects in the quality of the product, the service, the overall experience. And this is how you differentiate yourself. And all you have to do is walk around in Dubai Mall or on Tahliya Road in Riyadh today and look around you as far as how many competitors you have. And if you don't distinguish yourself by executing, you know, the best way, you won't, people won't come to your door.
Yes, I think, and experiences are from there. Now, in terms of people, what kind of people are you looking for? What's that special DNA, that special secret sauce that you're looking
for? So, I'll tell you, we in our business, they say the success is about location, 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 right? I think this success is people, people, people.
Right.
It really is. And I don't say that out of, you know, just buzzwords. It really is all about people. The way we look at people, the way we interview and screen for people, again, 10% technical, maybe 15% technical, and 85% or 90% is really people. So, you know, for key positions, for example, that I interview for, the person who I'm interviewing has already gone through 4 or 5 interviews with other people in our organization. I know he's technically qualified, right? So there's no point talking about his experience or, you know, what is he good at or what is he bad at. I talk to him about his family. I talk to him about where he envisions himself in 10 years. I try to sense from him what is his real core values and trying to understand and see if that matches with our organization. Mm-hmm. Because he could be the best manager in the world, but he may not fit with Cravia.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's today, really, and if you walk into our office, you'll get a feeling of that. It's one family. And what that allows you to do is allows you to have huge amounts of loyalty. Cravia, actually, we did a study at one point. Cravia is among the highest, has the highest retention rates in the whole industry. So we have people who, for example, a team of, I think, 5 or 6 that started Zaatar Zayt on the management side are still with us. One of the first employees, and I'm proud to say this, one of the first employees at Cravia is a barista at Seattle Best Coffee in Abu Dhabi, which is our first store. Mm-hmm. Today, he's an operational director. He's the second person in charge. Mm-hmm. The accountant who started with us has been with us 15 years, you know, and goes on and on.
Right.
And there is so much value being derived by loyalty, both, you know, from a financial perspective and also from, you know, a motivation and inspiration perspective.
How do you inspire such loyalty? Because these are very, very creditable numbers.
Yeah.
What do you do to inspire that loyalty?
I'll tell you, Tariq, at the end of the day, you know, you have to remember that who you're dealing with, they're not employees. I mean, you know, they're people, right?
Yeah.
And especially in an environment and in geographies like here, when you have 90% are expats, people who left their countries, left their families, left their kids, and came to work to earn a living. If you remember that as a boss, if you remember that as an organization, and if you reflect it in everything that you do, from obviously money is important.
Yeah,
you have to compensate them right.
Yeah.
But you also have to think about their housing. You have to also think about the sufferings that we do. I'll give you an example. One of the things that we do every year, we gather people in Ramadan. So we get the whole organization.
Mm-hmm.
And last time we had 1,200 people in one room. And I stand and I, you know, in front of them, it's usually a Ramadan iftar, and that's why most of the stores anyway are closed. So I stand in front of them and I say, okay, I'm here, ask me any question you want. You know, when we were 5 or 6 stores, I could go around and meet everyone. But when you're 75 restaurants in 3 different markets, it's impossible to do that. And the amount of feedback that I get, it's inspiring, honestly. And it's not about, you know, saying how great we are, but it's about, you know, you know what? Our housing, our buses are not comfortable. They're late. We get stuck in traffic. How about we change the times of you know, the different shifts, and all that adds value. And if you know, the biggest thing that I find people receive well is that when you actually take action based on that feedback, and we communicate it through our newsletter, and that's how we get loyalty, I think.
Are you using any kind of modern techniques to communicate with your 1,200 team members?
So we have a newsletter that goes out to all the employees across all the countries.
Physical or digital?
A physical one.
Okay.
We try to look at the digital, you know, version of it. But we have to be practical. Not everybody's going to open the digital one. So what we do is we go, we have a housing building in Sharjah. We put, you know, 500 stacks there. Sure. We say, give it away to our restaurants.
And the reason I'm asking that question is that, which is preempting a future question, is when we're looking at scale, how do you grow from 1,200 people to 12,000 people?
Yeah.
How do you, rather than growing by 10, 20% a year, how do you grow 10x? How do you
with
grow
difficulty.
10 times? Perhaps with difficulty, but what are the basics that you, you know, the building blocks, the toolkit that you've placed there?
Yeah.
How? What is that toolkit that enables you to grow from four great franchises to 40?
Yeah.
How would you do that?
I think the key, and I'm speaking out of our experience, and every company may have a different take on it. Mm-hmm. But the way I look at it is you have to be able to empower people at different levels of the organization. The second thing that you have to do is you have to be able to provide the foundation for growth. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, is a key, pitfall that people fall into every once in a while. And that is, you know, when you build a building 100 stories high, if you don't have the foundation to support it, it's going to collapse at 20th floor. Yeah. And, we have built the right infrastructure, and we invested ahead of the curve. So we built the organization long before we had the volumes, in the hope that we're going to get to these volumes.
I think that's the story of Dubai. They built
absolutely
dry docks before the ships were there.
Yes.
They built the airport before
build
the passengers
it and they'll come.
Build it and they'll come. And they will come.
Yeah.
So you've obviously built a great organization which has loyalty, and there's obviously a special touch. If somebody wants to apply to you, what would you look for? And what are the core values and what should be on their CV? What do you see on a CV when it arrives on your desk?
So, I mean, I glance over the experience. I understand. Yeah. I care about loyalty a great deal. So someone who's jumped, ships every 2-3 years does not appeal to me.
Yeah.
The other thing is when I sit with a person, I need to understand what their dreams are, what they're looking for. You know, I want someone who can, in 10 years from now, we can sit together and talk about this company and he's still with us, being part of this family.
Yeah.
So, we want to understand what their aspirations are, what their core value is, and see if that fits within the organization.
The industry is changing, the way people apply for jobs is changing. You know, in our lives, if we had 3 or 4 jobs in our lifetimes, we were doing fine.
Yeah.
In our parents' lives, is normally 1. If they're doing badly, it's 2.
Sure.
But a young person coming in today has lots and lots.
Yeah.
So one of my questions from that is the old measure of moving different jobs is just somebody being curious and learning lots of things rather than lack of loyalty.
Sure.
Would you subscribe to that or you don't feel that?
Partially I do. Okay. Partially I do. And I tell you, I mean, when we look at the resume, if we look at someone who's jumped companies 1 or 2 years apart in the same industry, I would raise a question mark.
Right.
Because it means that they want to be in the industry, but they're just trying out or maybe they're not, successful in certain setups. If they're switching jobs within industries or across industries, then that is something that I aspire to. And I would actually sit with that person and understand that maybe they found, their dream in our industry.
There's a Yale professor who came up with what he called a reverse CV, a flip CV, which is he wrote about his entire list of all his failures in his life and what he learned from them.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that he missed, the things he didn't do, but each one of them was a learning experience.
Yeah.
If that CV arrived on you, on your desk, what would you do?
I would call the guy for an interview immediately because somebody who looks at a job, at a career that way is the right way. I think it's all about trying, it's all about taking risks. And if there are no failures, I think there's something wrong in that formula.
What's next? You've built the platform, you've got the baseline there.
Yeah.
How do you grow from here? And what wakes you up in the morning and says, to jump out of bed and say, here's another day, I'm going to go out there and do something fresh?
You know, at the core of what drives me and at the core of the values of Caravia is growth. I think, stagnant means getting, you're going to die in a few years. If you don't grow, you're going to die in a few years. And I aspire to that and subscribe to that concept a great deal. So what keeps me up at night, if you will, if I, take a different spin at what you're asking, is how do we grow?
Yeah.
And, how do we grow in an environment that's extremely competitive? that that's becoming more and more difficult to do business in as well. I mean, whether it's here or in Saudi Arabia or in Bahrain or in Qatar, whatever the markets that we're in. And, you know, at the end of the day, how do we grow depends on, I believe, truly, the people that you have in place. Mm-hmm. And what I try to focus on as we grow bigger is my ability to try to spot opportunities, mm-hmm. spot new brands, even create our own brands at mm-hmm. one point, and being able to get that and then, you know, try to take it and run with it. Mm-hmm. I think growing from scratch to mm-hmm. where we are today mm-hmm. is much easier than growing from where we are today to where we aspire to be.
Right.
And I think that's going to be the next challenge.
So talking about challenges, what do you think is your biggest threat in the environment? Is it technology? Is it health-related products coming in versus the more traditional franchises, which are more impulse-based?
Yeah.
What do you think is the key threat to you?
You know, I look at threats from a totally different angle, to be honest. I don't see it to be product-related.
Yeah.
I see it to be more sort of talent-oriented.
Okay.
And I think, you know, attracting and maintaining the right people is going to be the biggest threat and the biggest challenge. And the reason why I say that is, you know, just the amount, first of all, the amount of competition within the industry, but also more importantly, you know, the new industries that come in that attract the young crowd.
Yeah.
You know, people want to be in technology more than food, sexier, right?
Yeah.
It's more, maybe more challenging to some of them. So how do we make our company, our organization, you know, compete yeah. not only in the food industry, but yeah. compete across all industries yeah. to attract the right talent? I think this is going to be the biggest threat.
Let me take you back to your Harvard Business School case study and what you did there.
Yeah.
We're both Howard alums, so we're in good company. and Professor Linda Applegate,
yes.
I think she inspired
friend.
You. Yeah. Tell us about that journey and what it meant and what did you learn and how
sure.
can we share that?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, 25 years ago,
yeah.
or maybe less, I was sitting in a classroom as a year one student in the MBA program at Harvard. I had just met my to-be wife, who's my fiancée at the time,
yeah.
and I wanted to impress her and take her to an HBS class, right?
Yes.
So I took her, sat her next to me, and I yeah. said, Maha, you know, this is a case, here's yeah. the case, and wouldn't it be cool if yeah. one day we had a case about my company? And, you know, 20 years later, Harvard Business School wrote a case about Cravia. I went with my wife to attend that class, and it was an unbelievable sense of achievement, an unbelievable feeling. The case itself actually is quite a good, simple case to teach, not only in the Harvard Business School only, but really particularly in our region. The nice thing about the story of Cravia is that it takes a company from being an idea to being a business plan, to being, you know, launched, to growth, and then maybe to exit at one point as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you see all that, and you know, people, I was in Harvard as well in November last year in a Harvard Arab Weekend conference, mm-hmm. and the majority of the people who attend are, you know, young students, Arab students from all over the States. Mm-hmm. And really, they were very, I would say, you know, I went there to get to inspire. I yeah. got inspired
right.
because the amount of energy that there is that exists mm-hmm. from these people, what they want to achieve, and you know, and what they want to take back to their countries, and you know, the businesses they want to establish is phenomenal. So I, it's been an inspirational process for sure.
You were discussing your case study, and so what did you feel when you and your wife were there? Listening to your case study and your company being discussed by hundreds of students, tell us your emotion then.
I'll tell you, I mean, talking about it right now gives me goosebumps.
I was going to say, maybe
yeah,
tears.
Well, yeah, I'll hold myself, but it was very emotional. It yeah. was extremely emotional. You have no idea how, you know, the sense of pride that you have when you're sitting among 100 bright students, right? Mm-hmm. You're talking about Harvard, the brightest of the bright. Mm-hmm. who are talking about your company. Mm-hmm. Because in the initial stage of yeah. the class, you sit back and they discuss the case, they talk about the company, what you did right, what you did wrong. And, you know, I was really overwhelmed by the emotions. I mean, you know, the value that I got out of there was also interesting. I mean, there were a lot of ideas that came, you know, bounced right, left, and center. But at the end of the day, the emotion and that satisfaction and that feeling of achievement was phenomenal.
In the same vein, let's now look at the next stage of your life. Let's visualize that today is your 90th birthday. We've come here to E173 and we're celebrating your birthday.
Right.
What will we be saying? What have we achieved? What will your daughters be doing?
First, I'll be grateful I'm alive.
You will be. Don't worry.
That would be a big thing. You know, Tarek, I think about that in whole different ways many times. But you know, you go through a stage of your life where you know you want to achieve something. You want to, you know, maybe satisfy certain requirements. You want to make money. You want to have a sense of recognition and achievement. And I think I've sort of passed that. And now, really, I think in the next stage of my life, and until I'm hopefully 90. When we sit back here again. Sure. I'm not going to ask you how old you're going to be, but I think I want to try to inflict changes on people's lives as much as possible.
Right.
What does that mean? I don't know. And I hope that we can sit here in whatever, 60, 70 years from now, mm-hmm. or less, 50 years than now, and say, you know what, we have a deep sense of satisfaction that we try to and changed people's lives as much as possible. And a big thing to me, and that's one of the things I try to change people's lives in, is to try to bring up kids mm-hmm. that are able to carry that forward, that have the same sense of value, that are good, global citizens. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, life gets tougher every year. Mm-hmm. And you think about raising kids in particular. And I think this would be, if you ask me if there's one legacy I'd like to leave behind, it's really my kids. So I hope they'll be the one who will be sitting with us and telling you more.
Do you think that you have the courage, the inner courage to reinvent yourself completely? And I will go even further. Do you have the courage to reinvent yourself every decade for the next 3 or 4 decades?
Yeah, I actually cannot live stagnant. I like to always look in the mirror, see what's missing, mm-hmm. Come up with a new challenge. Whatever that is. I mean, it could be personal, it could be business.
Sure. And what could those reinventions be to yourself? How would you redefine yourself? Would you come back as a teacher?
Yeah.
So say the next decade as a teacher, would it the next decade be, as a philanthropist?
Yeah.
Could the next decade be as an artist? Could the next decade be, the reason I say that is that because you reach that inflection point, you can either cruise or you can take off.
You know, Tarek, I think you chose the worst time for this interview because I don't know. I'm going through that thinking process right now.
Which is good. It's actually, at least you're reflecting.
Yes.
And so what are the thoughts that are coming? Because your journey is everybody's story, my story, your story, is how do we define ourselves?
Yeah.
So it's not looking for crisp answer. I'm actually looking for sharing your thoughts and emotions.
Sure. So I'll tell you, my thoughts on this is the beauty about all this is the adventure. Mm-hmm. And part of the adventure is not knowing what you're going to embark into next. There's definitely going to be a new journey. I sold a big chunk of my company recently, and I've decided for the next few months, I'm not going to decide on anything. Mm-hmm. And maybe for the next year, I'm going to give this a huge amount of thought. I'm going to talk to a lot of people because I'd like to be also inspired and think about. But at the end of the day, really what matters to me the most is that I'm happy. I wake up every morning.
Sure.
The beauty about Cravia and the reason I think why we're all successful in Cravia is that every day I wake up looking forward to going to the office and, dealing with the challenges, traveling, getting new stores open, getting new markets open. Mm-hmm. I don't want to lose that fire. And I think whatever is going to be the new, diesel or the new fuel to my fire, whatever it is, I still need it. Otherwise,
because this fire becomes like an injection.
It's addictive.
It's addictive.
It's extremely addictive.
That's what I mean. And one of the I'm going through that journey myself right now and redefining myself at this stage. I'm doing completely crazy things.
Yeah.
My company's called Mad. I mean, how much crazy can I be than that?
Very, very appropriate name, right?
Exactly. So, and I'm thinking to myself, what are the 2 or 3 ingredients that I need to put into my casserole that I'm building for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And for me personally, and I'll share my emotion on this, my number one is courage.
Mm.
To have the courage to change, to take things on your chin and whatever. Second is versatility.
Mm.
And third is humility.
Yep.
If you can be humble and you can live with yourself,
True.
You will find your passion, you will find your happiness,
yep,
and your contentment.
And I think, you know, to me, really, I need to come up with these things. But one of the things that I've always think about, and I'm not doing enough of, is giving back. And giving back, not necessarily just in money, but just giving back. You know, again, when I went to Harvard and we talked about the Harvard Arab Weekend and talked to students, the idea was really to go and, you know, I was asked to come there so I can inspire people.
Yeah.
I really got a kick out of it. I got inspired.
Yeah.
Looking at these youngsters, you know, I tell you a story. A guy walks to me, and this is the funniest story. So we were sitting in this class talking about the case. And then, you know, there were questions, but at the end, a lot of people walked to me and tried to ask me questions, 90% of them from the Arab world. Mm-hmm. And then this Chinese guy walks to me, mm-hmm, and he looks at me and says, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. Mm-hmm. And he started talking in Arabic, fluent Arabic, blew me away, right? And he said, I love the Arab world.
Yeah.
You know, I learned the language. He spoke it very, very fluently. And he said, I want an opportunity to work in your organization. And I said, you know what? You're hired. Mm-hmm. You're hired. Because that kind of drive, that kind of inspiration.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm hoping that, you know, in the next, whatever, 10 years of my life, that I'm going to, you know, face, you know, inspiring people and inspiring stories that would let me decide what to do next. However, one of the things that I will always be, at least the way I feel now, and things can change, I'd always like to be in the entrepreneurship sector. I mean, you know, I built a great organization as far as, you know, in the food sector. I don't know if I'm going to go into operations again or build new organizations, but to start something new, to see something flourish from being, you know, a startup all the way to being a proper organization, would be a dream. I mean, maybe it would be act number two, but it will be in a different setting and a new adventure, so to speak.
A new adventure is almost when you are just a little bit scared.
Yeah.
When you do that,
yeah,
you need
that. I don't want to be too comfortable.
Exactly.
I don't want to be too comfortable, for sure, for sure.
Yeah.
I think, again, comfort is such, you know, such a nice thing to have and obviously a blessing. Yeah. But again, I think what keeps me running and keeps that fuel going is the adventure.
What advice do you give to young people in terms of what they should do to emulate you and be inspired by you in terms of leadership?
You know, what I've done is not unique to me. And there are so many stories, especially in the Middle East and the Arab stories, and we talked about it. They're not, you know, they're not out there, but there are so many stories. One of the things that I always tell people who are looking to establishing their businesses and who are looking to being, you know, in the entrepreneurship sector, be driven by your passion.
Yeah.
If you wake up every morning loving what you're doing, I guarantee you, whatever it is, if it's cleaning the streets, mm-hmm, or cleaning cars or selling technology or selling food, mm-hmm, at the end of the day, if you love what you're doing, you're going to be so successful in it. And being persistent. You know, I mean, a lot of people today, you know, obviously chase a dream and try out, and they're being curious and looking at many things. But just, you know, if something is failing, you try again. Mm-hmm. You try over and over again until you get it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, by the way, when I was a young kid, and you were asking me if I was naughty or not, one of the things that always used to be told to me is that I'm stubborn. And it was given to me as a negative, by the
yes,
way. But it is, it's probably one of the most positive things a person can have, and you can look at it in a different way.
Indeed.
You know, not giving up, staying persistent, and staying stubborn is key.
Yeah. Stubborn about vision, stubborn about achievement.
Yes, exactly.
And
flexible on execution.
Flexible on execution.
Yep, yep.
Absolutely. What advice would you give to your 25-year-old self, yourself?
Well, I would take more risks earlier.
Even more?
Even more. Even more. I took you know, this risk of coming here and establishing Cravia when I was 35 or 34.
Right.
I would have taken it fresh out of college.
I interviewed a guy who's now a billionaire, and he left school when he was 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked, what was your biggest regret? He said, I wish I had left school earlier. So he is completely raw. He's from Africa.
Yes,
he's from
yes.
Rwanda. And he's completely raw. And that is has that naivety,
sure,
that energy is quite amazing. What advice do you give to employers, people who are now, because this region needs jobs.
Yeah.
What advice, you as an employer, and what advice would you give to employers in terms of the nature of people that you can hire, and how to empower a whole new generation? Because there is a lot of people are losing a little bit of hope.
Yeah.
And we need to energize them back again.
I think the key of the point about empowerment is extremely important. Mm-hmm. You know, I find people hiring employees for the sake of doing a job.
Yeah.
Rather than really building a business and growing a business and so on. And I think this lacks. The other thing that I, you know, as an organization, I think Caravia has, which is very unique in this region, is this focus on corporate culture and the ability to create a harmonious culture among, you know, 1,700, 2,000 people that can bring them together and keep them together. I think this is, these two things are very important. They give the sense for the employee, for the new, you know, graduate or whatever it is, a sense of belonging. And I think that's something that's not available and lacking in many organizations.
Is there anything that I have missed? Would you like to share? Would you like to add? Because I may not have asked you that question.
No, I think the only thing I would add is this value of family. And I believe strongly in the family values that I was brought up with, that I also try to instill in my kids. And that usually, you know, goes unnoticed. But to me, it was a huge support, you know, system. I think without my wife, my parents, my kids even, I don't think I'll be where I am professionally. So I think, you know, finding the right support system, whatever that is extremely important for the entrepreneur.
We are here with Waleed Al-Haj, who is a wonderful family man, and he's spoken about the culture and the values there. He's built a great organization. He has the most loyal team you can ever find. And he's at that stage and that inflection point in his life where he can take off. And he has wonderful plans for the next 40, 50 years until his 90th birthday. So you've done a lot of things and we've shared a lot of things. But I think the most important thing is that he has been authentic, he's been real, and he's helped to work with you and inspire you. And I hope you found his stories interesting and fun. Waleed, real pleasure.
Thank you, Tarek. Pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.